Hey there, welcome to Rewind Rewatch. I am the oldest sibling, Andrine.
And I'm her brother, Joel. And we are siblings that decided to make a podcast about the thing that we love, 90s movies.
Yes. I mean, we love everything 90s anyway. But for this podcast, what we want to do is basically look at 90s movies and then discuss whether or not they've aged well based on today's standards.
So we'll think about the themes, some of our favorite quotes, and at the end, we will rate these movies on a scale from 1 to 5 rewinds based on how likely it is for us to rewatch them again.
How do you think we'll rate your favorite 90s movies? You gotta listen in to find out.
So here's what happened, dumb 4-year-old.
It's Predator collecting people's, you know, skeletons and skulls.
Oh man, Superman ran away.
Hey, you know, Boba Fett can do it anyway.
So they can have a little, you know, romp in the silver cushion sack?
No one does that in real life. That's not a thing.
Hello, and welcome to Movie
Smash!
Hello, and welcome to Movie Smash, the show where we dive headfirst into comic book movies outside the MCU. If you're new to the show, thanks for joining us. If you've been here before, you know the drill. Each episode, we're going to smash a movie whose source material is from a graphic novel or a comic. Is it worth revisiting? Should it be forgotten? Let's find out. This is Movie Smash. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Roberts. I'm the founder of Off Panel Creations. With me today, I have a friend of mine who always has a cellophane logo of the letter J for going to bed, Jeremy Barmatier.
I do have a cellophane logo. I also gave away my powers for love as well, but for the love of old video games that I cover every week on the Retrovaniacs podcast, as well as this.
And we have a guest host today. It's actually our first sci-fi author, Aaron Ryan.
How's it going? I am a, I love to say this now because I can say it. I'm an award-winning and best-selling author. I wrote the Dissonant six-book hexalogy, which used to be a trilogy, then it became a quadrilogy, and then a tetralogy, and then a pentalogy, which is, and then a hexalogy, which is six. So proud of how it turned out. It's set in 2026. That's when the aliens come, so nobody panic. We have some time. It just turned out really good. I'm so pleased with how it turned out. And then I'm working on a follow-up, or a next series that is a post-apocalyptic Christian clean fiction YA series. Finish number one, publishing tomorrow. So this is timely. I may mention it accidentally during this podcast, here and there. And then number two is going to the editor, or is with the editor. But man, it turned out really good. So very excited and grateful. You know, if I could write anything Superman, I have loved Superman, and in fact, if I could turn my camera, and I know you're doing audio, but if I could somehow make this audio scene, at least just for you guys, I have Superman, 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 and then I don't remember where I got the scale model, but it's a Christopher Reeve Superman, you know, like, looks just like him. Detachable hands, and you can, you know, put fist or flying open hands. Got it many years ago. I love Superman ever since I was a baby. So, yeah, I'm in the right place here.
And that brings us to our movie tonight, 1980s Superman 2, starring Gene Hackman, Christopher Reeve, Margot Kidder, and directed by Richard Lester.
Superman 2. The adventure continues with the three villains from Krypton. Each one with the same powers as Superman. Each one dedicated to violence against mankind.
Think of it. Three supervillains. Or four, if you count him twice.
Let me start there, Aaron. Why did you pick Superman 2?
Well, gosh, I mean, is it Donner or is it Lester? We know it's Lester. We know it's Lester for the record. I grew up with that, man. I was 7 years old when that movie came out. I was, four when Superman came out, or five, I guess, in 78. Both such great movies, fantastic movies. I love the follow-up. I think that the campiness of just of current movies, like especially the Batman trilogy, the original ones after Tim Burton. Yeah, Tim Burton directed the original and then the Batman Returns. And then, you know, Joel Schumacher and everybody else after that and Clooney and it just kind of went so campy and so silly. But I think that the camp is really balanced out with so much emotional weight and sincerity in number two. I think that it just has a level of maturity to it that outweighs the camp. But the camp is so good in the 80s. The campiness was such, it was like indispensable in the 80s movies. So it makes it a really worthy follow-up to number one. And you know, I mean, anybody who knows the fandom knows they were filmed at the same time. I think that there was a continuity there that is really lacking in some movies today in sequels. But so you have the continuity, and you have the camp, and you have the sincerity, and you have Superman. So you can't go wrong.
So I take it the two of you were familiar with Superman as a character before seeing this movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's Superman. There, if there's one listener, and I need, if you are a listener to this podcast and you don't know who Superman is, one, I don't know how you missed our earlier Superman movie review, but if you did, and you still don't know who Superman is somehow, and you're still interested in comic book movies, I'll be shocked. But yes, of course, we're familiar with Superman. I cannot imagine that, like, never heard of him. This movie's great. I hope there's more about him somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, Christopher Reeve is, I mean, gosh, I'm a member of a number of different Superman groups and just other groups on Facebook, but it always comes down to the argument of who is the quintessential Superman. I absolutely love Henry Cavill. I thought he was fantastic in Man of Steel and Batman vs. Supes and all of that. But I think given what Christopher Reeve went through post the movies, just solidified and cemented his reputation as the quintessential Superman. He was phenomenal in the movies. He was phenomenal outside the movies, doing, you know, promotional work and talking about it and charity work. And then he was phenomenal after his accident. He's amazing.
We'll definitely get into it. So, Jeremy, do you have any comic book history for us on this unknown character, Superman?
So, Aaron, I have to say, normally we do a pretty in-depth comic book history in case you weren't familiar with the character. But again, we've already done an episode on the original Superman movie, the first one, where Fergal gave a much better detailed description of Superman than I would have possibly done. And two, it's Superman. You should know him. So he's a classic comic book character. He is the superhero. When you think about superheroes, he's the kind of the quintessential universal good guy. Like, even when he has a dark turn, it's not as dark as other characters. He's not Batman, where he has this gritty other side. He's like the good guy superhero with powers that make him, you know, as far as regular criminals on Earth go, impossible to defeat. So he's a staple of this genre. He is kind of the archetype for all superheroes. So he's Superman.
Yeah.
Before we get started, quick spoiler warning. If this is your first time joining us, just a heads up. We're going to discuss certain elements of this movie that might be considered spoilers. Granted, it's a 40-plus-year-old movie, so if you have not seen it by this point, you probably will never see this movie. But you probably should. Anyway, consider yourself warned. So, Aaron, why don't you walk us through what happens in this movie?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's you don't know exactly when it picks up after the events of Superman, the first one, but you know that Lex Luthor's incarcerated with Otis. It immediately starts with kind of a series of flashbacks, revisiting some of the key pivotal moments of Superman, and it leads into this segue that shows the incarceration of General Zod and Ursa and Non in the Phantom Zone, and they're flying through space. And then it brings us back to Earth for the setting, which is Paris. There's a hydrogen bomb that's about to be detonated over Paris from the Eiffel Tower. And Superman saves the day, of course, flies, swoops in, you know, rescues Lois Lane, who's, you know, stupidly mounted herself on the bottom of this elevator for a Pulitzer, or no, it was a Nobel Prize, N-O-B-E-L Prize. She spells it on the way up. Anyway, spoiler. I know that's a huge spoiler. She spells Nobel on the way up. Sorry. But he basically takes the entire hydrogen bomb, elevator included, launches it way out into the deep recesses of space, you know, to clear planet Earth, and the moon and everything, blows up in space, just happens to be on the same exact trajectory as the Phantom Zone square that the three, you know, antagonists are incarcerated in. And through a series of phenomenal 80s graphics, you see the square, you know, collide with the sound waves and the concussion blasts of the nuclear or the hydrogen bomb going off. They're freed. They come to Earth. First of all, they, you know, a short reign of terror on the moon and kill some people off there. They get, you know, their feet wet with, you know, murderous treachery and so forth. They like it, and they come to Earth and try to rule everything in a small, you know, Midwestern town, and gradually become aware that Kal-El, the son of their jailer, Jor-El, is on Earth and goes by the name Nom de Voix, Superman, which is who Lex Luthor refers him to. And Lex Luthor joins forces with them because he's visited the Fortress of Solitude and he understands who they are. He wants to combine forces with them. And so he's kind of their liege as they go through and filling him in on who Superman is and who's important to Superman. Classic, you know, colossal battle over Metropolis, with the three anti-heroes and Superman. Superman renounces his powers at one point, goes into an isolation chamber in the Fortress of Solitude, which he's made a commitment to live as a mortal with Lois Lane. So he strips himself of all of his powers. He is immortal. He gets beat up, quickly learns that was a stupid idea. Hey, nobody's immune from stupidity, even if you're from Krypton. He makes that foolish move, somehow is able to go back and find the green crystal, restores his powers, becomes Superman once more, and then engages in that fight. And he, with the partnership of Lois Lane, actually, who gets in a wonderful, fantastic sucker punch of Ursa in the Fortress of Solitude, knock them all out, and they banish them into the fog of the ether of the lower celestial dungeons of the Fortress of Solitude, and then the credits roll. So I don't know if that was short enough, but I can try again another time.
I think you make Jeremy proud.
That's good. Nah, that's very in-depth. I'm very happy with that summary.
So why don't we jump into it? And I think there are a few characters in this movie. So why don't we start with the villains? Because you kind of mentioned that they are put in this floating disc through space, the Phantom Zone. So What did you guys think of the new villains for this movie versus the first one?
I absolutely love Terrence Stamp. Terrence Stamp is amazing, and I don't remember the actor's name who played the chief villain. Jonathan something or other played the chief villain in Something Wicked This Way Comes, and he was in a Bond movie as well. That guy is amazing, and I'd never heard anybody to match his presence, his malevolent presence in his voice. But Terrence Stamp just has this big, you know, bassy, baritone-y voice and these glowering eyes, you know, set under thick eyebrows. He was perfect in that role. Non as the lumbering henchman, you know, you just don't want to tangle with that guy. And Ursa is just this seductive beauty who's amazing. I think they're all they complemented each other well. I think Terrence Stamp, though, stole the show as far as all of the villains together. And he was a force to be reckoned with. The fight that they have in Metropolis on top of taxis and, you know, flying through the air and, you know, getting trapped behind a bus and everything. He was amazing in that role.
As a comparison to the original Superman movie that we talked about, you know, not my problem, but it's an origin story. So it's about him kind of fighting against a criminal mastermind, but still ultimately a person, right? So you have to add the kryptonite. You have to make it so he has a weakness that makes him a lot less super. In this case, you know, you go the other route where the enemies instead have to be as strong as Superman. And in this case, they do it by having all three of them be also from planet Krypton. Again, they get here through that negative zone. But I thought Stamp as General Zod was great because you're right. I didn't think about it at the time, but they could have easily like given him some effect on his voice or something to make him more threatening, but not, you don't have to. He comes across as controlling but in control, right? Not just like controlling and you have to follow his mind for any reason. Like it's like, no, he has that natural kind of leadership tone, but also like he's so deadpan with when things happen. It's like he immediately reasons out why things are occurring to them, why they have these powers. He's a good kind of leader of these three. Now, he's the only one that was not created for this movie. Zod was in the comics before. Both Ursa and Nan were not specifically in the comics. They are now. They were created after this movie because they were so well-received. There were other Kryptonians, I guess, that were with Zod that were in the comics, but neither of those two specific characters were. I'm sure they were basically an amalgamation of these different characters, but they were later on added officially to the canon. Because they were so well-received in this movie. So yeah, all three of them are great supervillains. They play off each other well. Having more than one makes it easy to say, you know, yeah, sure, they haven't mastered their powers yet. As they're learning them as they're going through the movie, they're like, oh, we can check out what my breath does. Check out these eye lasers. Like, they show that stuff, which is cool, where Superman's been on Earth his entire life. He knows his powers. Although, as we'll find out as we go through this, he has some other ones that appear in this movie that I'm not quite sure where they came from, but that's okay. He's had more time than them to figure out how to use his powers on Earth.
Looking back, when I remember watching this movie, General Zod felt like a tactician. He felt very intelligent, very smart. But what got me rewatching this was that opening scene of when he's captured. It felt really like a bad set of criminals, like just sort of three, you know, people walk into a place, they try stealing a thing, and then the trap sets around them. It felt very unlike who those characters are supposed to have been. And I was curious for you guys, like, how did you feel about that for them? Did that seem right to you to sort of just portray those characters?
I think the stage was set in number one, obviously, but I think, Jeremy, you're absolutely right to call him a tactician. I think one of the greatest plays that he made in that movie, obviously it was written in the script that way, but when he goes in and they finally infiltrate the White House and they have all of these personnel at the desk, and there's basically an imposter sitting at the desk covering for the president, and you know, he asks him to bow. He says, I see you're practiced in worshiping things that fly. Good, you know, rise before Zod, now kneel before Zod. And then the man kneels so quickly, and right away Zod goes, you are not the president. No one who leads so many could possibly kneel so quickly. So he knows what things are supposed to happen, and he can see between the lines and realize that this guy is basically a substitute to protect the president. Yeah, I just think, I don't know exactly how he was supposed to be or how things were supposed to have been set up, but I think he was just written brilliantly, and he was a good match for Superman, of course.
Oh yeah, like I said, in the movie itself, I felt he did a great job. It just that opening scene, we'll get the scenes in a bit, just felt a little off for him. It honestly feels strange going back and talking about some of these characters, because we talked about them in our previous episode about Superman 1, because it's effectively the same characters. But what other characters stood out to you guys want to talk about?
Well, I'd say if we're going to talk about Lex Luthor, we already brought him up. He does get involved in this, but he's definitely second fiddle to Zod as far as his, you know, like ultimately he plays a role in Zod's downfall. He does belong in the movie, but other than when you see him escape and kind of when he shows up at the end, he's really not in this. This is not a Lex Luthor as the supervillain story. It's more
he's comic relief.
Yeah. Him and I think Nahn to some level is comic relief too, which is okay. If you're going to have these three threatening space, you know, I guess other Kryptonians, but you know, they're basically aliens like Superman is. You kind of need to have something to balance out a little bit. I think this probably was probably a little dark, and they added a few more things in as they went on, because this is so much more of a threat than the original Superman movie was. You know, like there was a lot going on in that movie, but it was more like about Superman learning who he is and what his role is on Earth and everything else. Where the second one is now there's other bad Supermen, right? So you can't have them all be super threatening and dangerous. And at this time, I mean, the current movies, sure, everyone's bad, but that's different. It's a different time. these were not movies. They were not ready for superhero movies at this time like these. So I forgot what the point of my saying that was, Chris, you throw me off. So the other thing though, I think that helps. Yes. The origin seems a little weak, but then they do have that whole scene where you see Superman's mom explaining what the history of these generals is. And yes, it's not much more in depth, but it does give them a little more of a backstory. It's not just like, oh yeah, they're three criminals. Like, well, they're more than just three criminals. They're like three like super criminal masterminds. The fact that he's a general means that it's not like he's just some guy. He clearly was somebody of authority. Like they do put a little more in the backstory. It didn't bother me because much like Aaron, and I'm sure you, Chris, we've seen these movies for our entire lives. So they are the bad guys. You know who they are, but also the lore afterwards, if you read comics and follow up, there's more to General Zod. And so it's just kind of all blended together into like, yeah, I know who this guy is. But you're right. If I would have never seen this before and you just see the intro, you're kind of like, they just seem like bad guys that they've sent into space. I don't get why this is such a big deal. But there is a lot more to him.
See, it's funny. You mentioned Lex Luthor, how he doesn't feel like he's in the movie that much. That actually came down to a production problem. The Gene Hackman filmed all his parts during the first filming of the Superman 1, and he did not come back for the Superman 2 filming. So you'll right. See there's a part where he's in the White House. All this, there's only like maybe one scene after that where if you see him, he's always in the background, his back is turned to the camera, his voice is, you never see him actually speaking the words he's saying. Those are all stunt doubles.
Yeah.
As well as someone doing his voice for him, because Gene did not want to come back.
Well, both Gene Hackman and
Brando?
Yeah, Brando didn't come back. Of notable characters for the second. The footage they shot for Brando, they couldn't even use because there was a part of the contract. His contract basically said he'd get some crazy amount of the profits of the movie just by being in the footage he had filmed previously. So they just cut him out completely until it, you know, after he died, his family gave the rights back to the movie studio for some other Superman thing. And then they could retroactively use that to put it in for the newer cuts of the film. But he's not in this movie for a reason if you watch the original release.
Yeah, I think that's crazy. I mean, just a venture to me. I think that's absolutely crazy. And the rumors precede him, that his reputation precedes him. No one seemed to like Brando in the production of Superman. And I do remember hearing that. But I have to say, like, I don't have any relationship with Marlon Brando. I'm not going to rise up and defend him. But I also know, having watched Superman 4, the Salkinds were money savers.
Yeah.
And you could see that just through the effects, you know, and the silliness of just the whole production of 4. They were eager to, you know, save a dime on that and not splurge. I actually really like, though, that Brando did not make that repeat appearance in 2, and you get to, you know, see his mom rise to the fore, and you get to find out a little bit more about her. It's you got the paternal, obviously, when he essentially, you know, gives him this messianic blessing in Superman 1, and like, you're going to go save the world. But now you have the maternal blessing coming in, and she's reaching out to him. Are you sure this is what you want to do? I think that was really cool to see, what was her name? Whoever the actress is, Susanna York, who played his mom. I think she was wonderful in that role.
I think if you had not seen Superman 1 and only saw Superman 2, you wouldn't even be aware Brando existed, that character.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if he was even in the beginning when they showed the shots from Superman 1. I don't remember if he was in that or not.
He's not.
I mean, because I didn't even think about it, but you're right. I mean, he's not in the rest of the movie. That's okay. I do want to bring up one more person that wasn't in the first movie and back in this one. As Lois Lane, you've got Margot Kidder. She's fine. I still don't quite think she is. It was weird to see her smoking in the office in this. I know that's a time thing and not as much, but it was supposed to make her feel like worldly and you know, kind of gritty, and she's willing to do, but it just kind of, like, now it just seems kind of gross because no one smokes in office buildings or indoors. And
that while making healthy orange juice.
Yeah, well, yeah, lots of healthy orange juice while you're smoking your cigarette or whatever.
Right.
But no, I mean, I think she's fine. I don't know. I was never a big Lois Lane fan anyway, regardless of who was playing her, just the idea that Superman, you know, falls in love with the first person he really meets and knows once he moves to the city. And he's like, oh yeah, clearly I'm in love with this person. And in this, it's really, there's a lot of Lois and Clark in this, which there has to be to some level, but I think it's almost too much.
Well, remember though, I mean, Ursa herself said it, what an undemanding male this Superman must be, right? So he was not very demanding. And if you actually go through, she has like 80 different looks throughout the Superman movies, the two of them. So one scene, like after she jumps into, I don't know if this is a spoiler, but she jumps into the Niagara, the river, and he's forced to save her. He doesn't reveal himself, but he's forced to save her. And then they're in the honeymoon suite after that. She looks like she's wearing a wig. I mean, it looks absolutely like a wig. And it's just, what happened to you? So she's not my type. If you saw a picture of my wife, you would know that. She's not my type. But you look at her and there's scenes where she's like smoking hot in Superman. And then other scenes where you just go, ugh, you know, happened to you? Why are they making you look that way when you're, is that really to contribute to the undemanding male thing? I don't know.
So this movie, and Aaron, you kind of did it when you were telling the plot. It covers a lot of ground. It's just over 2 hours. This movie covers a ton of different scenes. Like, I was taking notes as I was watching to sort of hit the different scenes. And I couldn't believe how many different scenes there were for this movie as I was doing this.
And I have to say, Chris, we have a note sheet. No one's going to find this interesting, but maybe Aaron, since he went through this. But there we have a note sheet. And normally for every movie, there's like, we get to the scene section. And Chris has like 3, maybe 4 scenes highlighted. There's like 55 things this week. There's like, it's scene by scene. Like, here's a thing, here's a thing, here's a thing. And I'm like, yeah, all these things are worth mentioning. But it's funny because normally it's like, you can have a 90 minutes to 2 hour movie, and there's 4 bullet points. In this movie, nope, nonstop wall of events he wants to cover.
Well, I kept making jokes to myself as I'm watching. I'm like, oh, I made a joke during that scene. Let's add the scene. Now maybe someone wants to talk about it. And you're right. It just, because this movie covers so much ground. We're not going to cover all the scenes, obviously. Which ones do you guys want to talk about? Which ones do you find the funniest ones?
I don't know about funny. I mean, Aaron already mentioned it, but I do want to say that the intro scene where you see the three of them get sent to the negative zone, even though it's a pretty cheesy effect, I still love it. I love the whole negative zone capturing, and then watching them, they spin basically as this like glass plate through space where you see them on both sides like a mirror and it flips around. Love it. I mean, it seems like the cheesiest thing, like a Doctor Who effect, but I still love it. It's so good. Even now, I was like, this is great.
I love the Eiffel Tower scene. I think, and the Fortress of Solitude, but I mean, I'm just going to keep listing scenes as we're talking about. I also love this, and I love this, and I love this. I love the scene though when Lois is catapulting down to the ground underneath the elevator, and the hydrogen bomb is going with her. And I don't know how they do that. I just don't know how. I love how they do it though. You see from a ground level up, looking up towards the Eiffel Tower, and it's cemented in my memory, you know, from 7 years old, where the elevator is plummeting, and you see this figure. You know, whatever they use, it's a dummy, it's a miniature, I don't care. It's this little tiny figure that they're shooting at this model of the Eiffel Tower, and it looks so real. It looks so real, and it's perfectly parallel to where you would suspect his destination point would be, to rendezvous with that falling elevator. And then they switch to a graphic shot of him swooping in and coming underneath it that just doesn't quite look visually, you know, cohesive. But I love that whole scene, and where she goes, a bomb, a bomb. And he goes, I know. He takes off, and you hear the dun da da da. I mean, my wife and I went and saw, gosh, names are failing me tonight. John, the soundtrack guy, John Williams. Mm-hmm. We saw, like, it wasn't an opera, but it was a symphonic presentation of John Williams' hits. So Jurassic Park, Jaws, E.T., Superman, Star Wars. And all of them were phenomenal. But man, my heart swelled when they start playing the very first dun 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 dun, 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 dun. Oh, I was like, this is it. It was so powerful. So anytime the music comes in and it's a superheroic scene, I also love the anytime they're at, well, but not anytime, the whole Niagara Falls scene. I thought that was so cool where the little boy falls in and he goes behind the hot dog stand and he's trying desperately to keep his secret. I just think that whole cat and mouse chase between he and Lois Lane was fantastically done in the movie.
The Eiffel Tower scene was actually added to this recent cut because I think, Aaron, you mentioned it, that the Zod was freed because of a nuclear blast in space.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, that was supposed to be one of the rockets he threw during the first movie up into space, caused that explosion.
I think I remember hearing that. Yeah.
Yeah, and they decided not to use that footage for the second movie because, as we you kind of alluded to earlier, the two different directors, in order for the guy that got the credit to get the credit, he had to have filmed 51% of the movie. So he cut that out of it, out of the Eiffel Tower scene, to make sure he got over his 51%.
Yeah, that's crazy. I don't know if you guys have seen the Richard Donner cut. I have. It's very interesting, but obviously it's extraordinarily seamless because they're using like literally audition footage between he and Margot Kidder for the shooting him in the chest scene. And like, had you actually used a live bullet, I would be dead, of course. And she goes with blanks. You know, I think it's so cute, and it really would have been great to see that in the movie. But it's really jarring to watch the Richard Donner cut. Giving him credit, of course, because now you've added footage that puts it over that 51%. But I don't know. It's just it was more like a glory, self-aggrandizing project, I felt.
I was watching the movie and I saw the moon scene. Jeremy, I think you were alluding to that one about when Zod and his compatriots show up at the moon to fight the Russians, the Americans on the moon itself. I don't know. The effects of them flying in were just so bad. I remember from the first movie, I enjoyed Superman's flying, but for some reason, they could not get it right in a group shot.
The Superman in this movie, when he flies, it generally looks good. Christopher Reeves as Superman flying around, the effects still look good. I don't know if it's just like the training they put him through or whatever, the fact that he knew like, yeah, I did this before, I've done it already for this. I know they filmed a lot at the same time, but even the reshoots or whatever. Like, he looks fine. It's the posing that everyone else is doing when they're flying that's a little weird. On the moon, it made sense because they're not in Earth gravity. Even like regular people on the moon, if you're jumping up and down, you have the extra height, you have some extra float, there's all these other like abilities, so that didn't bother me. On the moon, I was like, this is fine. But by the time they get to Earth, especially the big fight scene in the city, specifically there are some really bizarre angles for his flight that just look really weird. Now again, it could be on purpose for Non, but I don't know. It doesn't ruin the movie by any means, but like, Superman still looks good. Like, when he's flying around this movie, sure, it looks a little dated. You can see it's a green screen or whatever if you compare it to something now. But for the time, it still holds up really well. But especially the Non and Ursa, some of their flights, you're like, ooh, that's not good. On the moon, it didn't bother me. But on Earth, I was like, yeah, that's not great.
I do like on the moon shot, Ursa kicks the guy in the crotch and shoots him off the moon.
I just love that. And when Zod like throws the guy out and then pulls his air thing off and just watches him fly off. That's great. It's just so cruel. Like, if you're out. And like when kids find bugs and they just like they pull the wings off a bug or something, like, sure, that's terrible, but it's a bug. You don't think about it. It's a bug. That's how they're treating people. And it's pretty great.
They actually cut out the Ursa kicking a guy in the crotch scene from the Japan release because they didn't want to show women being that cruel.
Wow. I think it was so funny because Zod did that as well before he actually yanked the oxygen cable from that guy. It's like, what's with them using their feet? You know, he had to. Why couldn't you just go give him a little push? You know, there he goes. You got gravity working for you, so it's going to catapult him off into space anyway. But it was like everyone wants to just show their legs or something here. It was very odd. I have a friend who I just remember when we were kids or young adults, actually reflecting back on how beloved this movie was. He would always do this impersonation of the guy, the fated last astronaut in the capsule, who Non is coming up on him and he's going to, you know, he's compressing the capsule and the guy's going, oh, no. No, and it's just it's the really cheesy, poor acting, and I mean, I just love it. Like, I wouldn't have it any other way. Oh no, it's so perfect to hear that over and over again. I would have that as my ringtone. Oh no, no.
Well, the camp on this is like you mentioned, it's really good. It doesn't come across as I don't want to say inauthentic, but it's almost like an aw geez. Like, there's so much of that in this movie. Like, when they're fighting in the city. And everyone in the town's like, yeah, Superman, you give him what for? Like, it's all like just so cheesy. You wouldn't see that in a current movie, really. And I love it in this. It still works. It makes it feel like wholesome-y. I don't know. I really do enjoy it.
Or the little kid after the fight's like, oh, man, Superman ran away.
Yeah.
He didn't even do nothing. I love the guy on the phone, the old elderly guy on the phone.
Laughing.
He falls over and he's like just absolutely unfazed at the cataclysm happening around him. I think it was like a standout scene in the middle of all this mayhem. He's not talking to anybody anymore. He's clearly senile, but it's just so cute.
Aaron, you talked earlier about the scene of where Superman gives up his superpowers, where he sort of sacrifices those to be with Lois, who I was watching that scene again, and it bewildered me a little bit because Lois fell in love with Superman, not with Clark. But he's giving his powers to become Clark, and he literally goes to a diner, gets in one fight, and just like, nah, this was a dumb idea. And remember, at the time, the bargain was, you cannot go back on this. This is it.
Correct.
But no, that's not the bargain. You can just go back and change it.
So that is what he is told.
Right, but I don't think Kryptonian mom knew about the Skate King glow stick. I don't think she knew about that. So, I mean, that helped change things a little bit. I think it's one of the coolest scenes in the whole movie when you have this, you know, they've got two shots overlaid, and here is the, you know, the Christopher Reeve shot getting ready to go film Somewhere in Time with Jane Seymour, you know, because he's in the white shirt and his hair is all fluffy and, you know, he's going out that way. And you see the old Superman with his hands up against the glass fading and bowing and dying. And I thought, oh, it's just brilliant. I mean, I could play that scene over and over again. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It was basically kind of a no turning back now type of thing. This is a one-way ticket. And somehow he's able to undo it, which, however that works out, it's not explained, it's not revealed, it's not shown. That's okay. You want Superman back, so you're willing to just kind of suspend disbelief and say, however he did it, fine by me. I think it was cool that he was willing to do that, but I think it was, a poor lesson for him to learn and horrible timing. The guy, the diner owner said, you know, where the hell you been, Mac, on a desert island?
Yeah.
And it's like, do you not, he said he doesn't watch the news, he's reading Dickens. He says that to Perry Mason. But it's like, do you not pay attention to any news? You had no idea Nahn and Ursa and General Zod were here? It's like, really poor timing.
Well, two things. One, when Superman gives his powers, I do love that transformation scene, right? It's the whole thing goes red, and then it has those effects where, like, you see his skin peeling back, but not in a horror movie way. Instead, it's a very much sciencey way. It kind of reminds me of, it's totally different, but the same way I love in the Disney's The Black Hole from 1978, I guess, or whatever.
Oh, I love that movie.
The whole transformation scene when they're in the black hole and they go into the black hole and you see like it's got the lighting thing, it's got flaring, you know, it's just these weird effects, but it all works because it's supposed to just be sciencey, right? I love that in movies from the time frame. And so the transformation has that same ability. But the other part I wanted to make was when he gets, what you see for Superman is he gives up his powers, he spends the night with Lois, and then they go to some diner where he gets his ass beat. But he doesn't go back because he got his ass beat. It's not that Superman's like, oh man, I made a mistake, I don't want to be a human. They're there. They see on the TV, they see that Zod and everyone else is, you know, in the White House and doing whatever. So that's when Superman's like, I have to go back. Even if he can't, it's not like he knows he can transform, but he doesn't know what else to do. And he knows he's the only person who can stop them if they're back here now. Because as soon as he hears Zod, he knows the name. So he's like, I've heard about Zod through these recordings that my mother left me or whatever. He's a bad guy. I've got to go back and see what I can do. I liked that. Also, if you, I think in the diner cut, because I saw some footage of it online, but I admittedly have not watched the whole diner cut. I believe that's where they use footage of Marlon Brando, and it's this trade-off where he basically is like, I gave my life for you once, and I can give the last of my spirit to bring you back, or something. Like, there's a big, I don't know if I'd say it's great or not, but at least they explain it somehow. In this, it's like, you see him get the crystal, and then he flies in to Metropolis, and you just have to, you're right, it's Superman at this time, especially because I would have seen it as a young child. It's like, yeah, it's Superman. You don't care why he's back necessarily. You're just glad that he's back. Now watching it, you're like, yeah, they wish I would have explained it a little more. But I also, and we haven't really gotten to the pacing yet, Chris, but I think this movie is long enough. If they went into a lot more detail on how he gets his power back, well, I think that's interesting. I don't know if it would be fitting in this movie at the point it's at. I think there's a lot of weird pacing here all around. So you kind of just like, you know what, let's keep this thing moving. We got Zod here. They're in the White House. They're doing their thing. Let's get Superman back here. So,
yeah. I enjoyed pretty much all the Zod fighting scenes. I enjoyed, like, when they're fighting off the army, they're kicking their butt on that. I like the fact that when Ursa, every time she fights somebody new, she takes one of their badges and somehow she sticks it to her uniform. I don't know how she does it, but she somehow makes it stick.
It's Predator collecting people's, you know, skeletons and skulls.
That's basically what it is. Like, she starts off with the NASA logo, then eventually like a deputy, then the army.
Well, because they're military, right? If it's General Zod, these are it's his love interest, but it's also like a lieutenant or whoever. So it's a military badge thing. You're just stealing these badges and putting them on your uniform. I love all the stuff with Zod, Ursa, and Nahn. All those scenes are good. Like, there's not one where I'm like, oh, I hate this. Even the ones where the flying is goofy, I still like the scenes. I love them as villains. Yeah. I mean, they're what I remember of this movie. Everything, I mean, you remember the Niagara Falls scene. You remember the whole thing. I've seen it enough times, but like, what stands out in this movie, the thing I was excited about when this was picked was like, oh yes, we got more Zod. We get Zod and the bad guys. Like, that's what I want to see. And I love all those scenes.
Yeah. No, me too. I absolutely like the people who were born to play certain roles. I don't care what Will Ferrell stars in. He will always be Elf. I don't care who Antonio Banderas stars in. He will always be Zorro. Christopher Reeve in Somewhere in Time. I'm sorry, that's Superman. And so you're watching like Yes Man. I think it's Yes Man. And Terrence Stamp is in there as that motivational speaker. And I'm sorry, that's General Zod up there. Yes. I don't care who it is. That's General Zod. So it's like you've made your mark as this character. Terrence Stamp has stamped, see what I did there, his mark on this character that he's branded for the rest of his life. So it's that memorable.
Enough time has passed between this movie, when I saw it as a kid, and then the movie Elektra, and Terrence Stamp's in that movie. He's plays Stick.
Stick, yeah.
I didn't make that connection until when I watched Superman 2 again, because like there's so much time has passed between those movies. He doesn't look the same.
No.
Yeah.
But then I saw him again as Zod. I'm like, wait a second. That's Stick. One thing, Jeremy, you mentioned that Superman's power seems to get acquire some new skills during this movie. What are some of those ridiculous ones he picked up?
They're both really at the end. The two that stand out to me are at the end of the movie. So everything else, like he has his flight, he has his laser eyes, all that stuff. You're like, yep, that's Superman power. Great. He has, when they first go to the Fortress of Solitude, when Zod and Nan and Ursa show up at the Fortress of Solitude at the end, Nan charges at him and he does this thing where he grabs his chest emblem and throws it like a giant cellophane wrap, and it wraps him up and throws him on the ground, then it fades away. I never understood what it is. It still looks pretty bad. It's probably the worst effect in the movie, but it's, again, campy. It works. I like it, but it's one of those like, why does he do that? But you don't question it as a kid. Now I was like, when there's a million things you could have done there. Instead, you give him a new power where he turns his suit into this wrap. Okay, whatever. And then at the end of the movie, after everything happens and, you know, they're back to kind of normal, he's trying to figure out how to live with Lois Lane, knowing who he is, but also how she can live, right? Not as much how he can live. He's fine with it. She's clearly not able to handle the fact that she knows he's Superman, and she wants to live with him and be with him, but he's going to be out all the time because he's Superman. That's what he does. He flies around at night, and you don't even know if he really sleeps. So she's like, she's freaking out. She can't handle it. He kisses her, and it erases her memory. Now, again, you don't see him kiss a lot of people. Maybe he could have done this whole time. I have no idea, but it comes out of nowhere, and they don't even really explain it. Like, she just kisses him, and all of a sudden she's like, well, that was fun. Anyway, doot-doot, and like, that's it. I was like, these are two superhero powers that I don't think Superman has in any other format, but they show up here. The cellophane one's my favorite, though, because it is so like, what?
And it's then so ridiculous.
Goes right back.
I think, like, if I could venture, point, counterpoint,
sure.
I love that. I thought it was just like the cellophane S, it was some kind of, it immobilized him. You know, it did the job, it immobilized him because Nan's coming at him, and all of a sudden he stopped mid-flight, drops, you know, what was that? But also the disappearing power, too. You never knew that he could teleport and also produce multiple versions of himself as decoys. You know, so he's got this power. But what if, I offer a thought, what if he was Superman 1.0 before he renounced his powers and went into the chamber? And then here comes Superman 2.0 that is suddenly imbued with more powers. And maybe there's some radioactive something or other that happened in the green Skate King, you know, glow stick. So something happened when he emerged from that that containment cell, and he was imbued with more powers then. And maybe he has even more beyond that. Who knows?
But do those powers carry over Superman 3 or Superman 4?
I don't see a lot of kissing of him in Superman 3.
No, he does not do the cellophane thing ever again.
You could do the logic of trying to say, well, he was in the Fortress of Solitude, and maybe it has some hologram abilities, or who knows?
I thought that was literally like Hall of Mirrors kind of stuff. But then you're right, they do it as well, and they aren't using it like a Hall of Mirrors. So it makes sense that it would be a superpower he's gained somehow in his rebirth. And that's at least an acceptable answer. I'm fine with that, because all those things happen after he is re-Supermaned, whatever you want to call it. So that is a valid point I didn't put into perspective. And again, part of that's because you don't really know how he becomes Superman again. He just does, and you're happy to see it. I as a kid, I didn't get the whole him tricking everybody and turning the red light on the outside, and that way he's safe in the canister. Like, I understood that's what was happening, but I didn't really, like, they tell you. I mean, Lex Luthor literally says it out loud so that you understand it. But even like when I watched it this time, you're like, okay, everything outside is red now. Like, that didn't happen last time because Lois was there in Washington. It wasn't real. Like, they give you all the clues, but I think they had to then have Lex say it for dumb 4-year-olds like me that needed you to spell it out. Say, here's what happened, dumb 4-year-old. But now I've watched it. It's like, oh, they didn't have to spell it out. I would have been actually happier with them not spelling it out, except that, again, perhaps I wouldn't have understood it even less as a kid.
As a kid, I wondered. I mean, obviously, he was there well before the triumvirate arrived with Lois and Luthor. So they're all he's there before they all get there, and he can tinker around with the equipment and reverse it or whatever, reverse the polarity. I loved that Luthor explained that afterwards. Oh, it's a revelation. He did it to them. You know, I see now he was safe in there. However, I always wondered as a kid, because this is what your mind does as a kid, do Lois and Lex now have powers? I mean, General Zod and Non and Ursa have no powers. There's some radiation exchange going on now. Like, are you going to see Super Lois and Super Lex? I was hoping for that, actually. It'd be a cool sequel.
At the end of the red light hits them all, they are quickly dispatched. And every one of the villains falls into some white fog under the Fort Solitude. My question for you is, are they dead?
I think it was more in comic book fashion. You never know. You never know if an enemy's dead unless you literally like see them like, oh yeah, they got smashed to pieces. And then, you know, the car explodes and the guy even like, yeah, we killed it. He's buried. We buried him. Like you need that level of finality. So not having that was okay. He's taken away their powers, which again, he couldn't get his back over time. It was literally, he had to find some way to regain his powers. You can assume they've lost their powers forever. They've fallen into an endless abyss somewhere. I mean, even if it's 30, 40 feet, they probably aren't going to survive anyway. But you don't know. So that way, if there was a future Superman where Zod comes back, you're like, ah, I knew it. Hey, you know, if Boba Fett can do it, anyone can. So it works out.
It looks kind of like liquid nitrogen. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we can give them that. Maybe they're frozen. Maybe he tossed it down in there and no one can survive that. So I don't care if you're from Krypton, you get frozen. But, you know, I think that's one of the stark differences between Man of Steel, for example, and this one, is that Man of Steel, he actually has to, he just doesn't want to. You see this clear and apparent conflict with Kal-El that he does not want to kill Zod. But Zod is going to, you know, that laser beam coming out of his eyes is eventually going to sever somebody in half or somebody's plural in half. So he does the only thing he can do, and it disassembles him afterwards. He breaks his neck, and it disassembles Kal-El, because this is the last other surviving member of Krypton, it looks like. And so he has to kill him. Well, this is much lighter fare in Superman 2 from 1980, and it's lots of kids are watching this, maybe younger ages kids. And so had he broken his neck, you know, or done something violent like that, it would have been really antithetical for Superman. So, you know, you toss this guy against the wall, he slides down, liquid nitrogen, done. And we replay that punch from Lois where she dukes Ursa. I mean, you're a real pain in the neck. Wop. The best female punch ever. I will, you know, fight me. I'll maintain that. I love that punch. And then she's done. And, you know, Non, he's just Non. So, you know, he's clumsy.
But he thinks he can't fly. He doesn't get that he's lost his power. So he tries to fly and he just falls in. I mean, it wasn't like he trips. That would have been funny. But it is more like you see he realizes halfway through his leap, oh, no. And that's it.
You don't really stand much of a chance if your name is Non.
No. I mean,
you kind of have the card stacked against you there.
There were two things I want to talk about that scene, though. When Lois punches Ursa, she actually, the actress actually hit her so hard she did knock her out.
Margot Kidder hit her, like, for real?
Yeah, for real. Knocked her, the actress who plays Ursa out in one shot.
Oh, my. Wow, I didn't know that.
The other thing is, the original script for the movie was, after all that big fight happens and Superman is leaving with Lois, the police show up and arrest Zod, Ursa, Non, and Lex Luthor.
I'm glad they didn't go with that, because there's a couple problems there, and I was going to bring this up and think some kind of like logic problems with this, that you have to get over the fact that Superman, there's going to be logic problems anyway, but there's a lot of things where like, they're out in the middle of nowhere, they're in the North Pole, they're in the Arctic, how is the police just going to show up and arrest them? Even if they take a plane or a helicopter, it also begs the question earlier, you know, when he's in the diner, like, hey, where have you been? Like, on a desert island? Conceivably, he flew them to the Fortress of Solitude and gives his powers away.
How do you get back?
How do they? Yeah, they build a boat. Like, what do they do to get back? They could have been stranded for 2 months. Who knows?
Well, they showed him walking back.
Well, yeah, he had to walk back afterwards by himself.
But how did him and Lois get from back? Like upstate New York back to the North Pole?
It's a long. Well, he was Superman. I guess now he's just a guy walking. You're right. I was going to say Superman, but you're right. He's just. But when Luthor escapes from prison early in the movie. He escapes on a hot air balloon that somehow the prison doesn't see, but they do see the guy with the ladder. But then he gets away on this big floating balloon, and they take it to the North Pole. That would be the longest balloon flight ever.
It would be. Poor Otis. I mean, it's such a comical, fun scene with him. And by the way, like I just watched Crimson Tide last night. I had to rewatch the movie. Such a great movie with Gene Hackman, quintessential actor. And I was thinking in prep for this today. he was the consummate professional. Every role that he did, like whether he was in whatever, I'm not going to list all the movies, but he was so good. I wonder if Gene Hackman died because of all of the alpha waves from his little black box in the cell. It's feasible to think of that, you know, it could happen. So anyway, it's an occupational hazard if you're going to do a movie with alpha waves.
So Jeremy sort of touched on it, pacing. This movie comes in at just at 2 hours and 7 minutes long.
So, and I said this about the first Superman. The first Superman is long. Like, you don't realize how long it is till we looked at it again. We're like, this is a long movie. And there's a lot of downtime where they explain who Superman is and how he fits in. It all works, but it's a very slow movie. This doesn't have that problem. Comparatively, it seems like it's a much better paced movie, but still it's long. I mean, you've got the first 90 minutes, aside from you get to see what's happening with Zod and all this stuff is in the background, but the actual Superman parts for the first 90 minutes are, you know, after the introduction where he stops the bomb in Paris, it's him and Lois hanging out at the Niagara Falls and like them kind of getting their relationship kind of formed as she figures out who Superman is. And he decides he's going to, I've got to tell her my feelings and show that I'm Superman. Also, like that's all there, but it's so long that I forgot how much time is in of that in this movie. It's a good 2/3 of the movie is Lois and Clark, but you need that level of connection so that his sacrifice makes any sense. Otherwise, if it was just like, well, Superman wants to get some, so he's going to go ahead and lose. Like you need that connection where it's more than just a hasty decision that Superman makes. And I still think, though, with that pacing, it does feel like it's a very quick decision because he doesn't know. Superman has no idea that he can do this. I mean, maybe it was in the books and stuff that he read, but it seems like he's learning this for the first time when you see his mom on the hologram or whatever telling him, like, well, here's the last question we thought you'd never ask or whatever. And so maybe he already had all those revelations previously and just wasn't sure if he ever was going to meet somebody to do that with. But it comes across really quick. He doesn't. This is a problem with a lot of movies where guys do things where you're like, why would you possibly do that? I mean, I've been married for long enough to know you don't just do things without talking about it first. And he's just like, well, I'm just going to give my powers away. And she sees him do it. She doesn't say stop. She has a chance. I guess she's willing to take the sacrifice as well. But it's one of those things where he's like, well, I'm going to do this. It's like, oh, yeah, I bought you a car. Like, well, you know, no one does that in real life. That's not a thing. You don't just buy your wife a car. It's a big decision. I mean, maybe if you have a lot of money. I don't. I don't have endless riches where I just buy cars at random. So giving up my superpowers when I'm the only person on the entire planet that has them. And it's not like he hasn't been helping the entire world, right? He's been taking nuclear bombs to space. He's been doing all these other things to help the entire world. So it's not like he's like, well, yeah, no one's really going to miss me. He's like, no, he's making this giant sacrifice. And it just seems very rushed because of you're limited to a time of a movie. Like if this was a TV series, this would be like a season 4 decision after 4 seasons of building these relationships out with more discussion between him and Lois about why he would have to make this sacrifice if he wants to be with her. And ultimately that's what he's going to do. Right. So instead you have to cram it into essentially a movie and a half to get to why is he making the sacrifice? And again, as a kid, it was like, well, of course he did. He's doing it for love. It makes sense. But now it's like, this seems really rushed for him to make this decision, but it's okay. The pacing is not slow, but it's weirdly paced. There's all these like long things to where they use it to attach why someone's in an area, why they are in Niagara Falls, what they're going to, you know, how she determines who Clark is over a movie and a half. But then when it's like, I'm going to give my powers up. It's like, yeah, I'm done. Like, okay.
So like, I totally, like, I absolutely appreciate that because it's eye opening. So Superman 1 is composed of 3 different acts. There's mm-hmm. Krypton, and then there's Smallville, and then there's Metropolis. Yes. And so that to me had like far more drag. I loved these cutaway shots going back to, okay, we can go to Clark and Lois. We can go to the 3 criminals. You know, we can go mm-hmm. to Lex Luthor and Miss Tessbacher. You know, we can go to those 3 different people. You have to say it that way. You can cut between those people and there's this inevitable conflict that all 3 paths are leading towards. But it's, you know, it's wide at the beginning of the movie. They're all widely spaced apart. And this inevitable conflagration is going to happen. But I really appreciate the pacing and the buildup. Because in that you need the super freaks, you need them to learn their powers. You need Lex Luthor to be able to track down the criminals and find them and join them and you know, fine tune his comic relief on the way. And you need Clark and Lois to build that budding, you know, human relationship too. So it didn't drag as much for me that way, far less than 1.
Yeah.
I think the pacing was fine. Again, this is coming from a 7-year-old who fell in love with this movie so much. And like, what's pace? You know, I just, this is cool. And that's cool. And that's cool. And that's cool. So it didn't bother me as much.
And not only that, you have to remember at the time, there weren't this whole slog of superhero movies to compare it to. You don't have, you know, oh yeah, I saw Spider-Man 3 and this is way slower than Spider-Man 3. And sure, it is. It's also way less ridiculous. These two movies are meant to be seen back to back. I know they weren't released back to back, but they essentially were, right? And they were filmed at the same time. You're supposed to have this connection that makes it work. And therefore, this movie does not seem slow. I remember seeing this at the time. I was like, I love this movie. The first one was slow and this one's the fast one, right? But now watching it, I was like, yeah, this is a little weirdly paced. But I'd say the same thing for I'm a big Star Wars guy, but my kids who are now 9 and 11, they have never watched any of the original Star Wars movies because they find them slow and boring, right? That's just, they like the idea and everyone likes I like Darth Vader. He's cool. Okay. I like, you know, all this. I like Jedis. I like all this stuff. They like the newer movies more. Not the newest ones, but the prequel movies. They like those. I don't think they hate the newer ones, but they're not as fast as the prequels. The prequels were like YouTube speed. Everything was just fast, fast, fast. There's lightsabers everywhere. There's 1,000 Jedis or stuff going on. So then you try to watch the originals and it was just like, I love those movies and I don't think they're badly paced, but I can see the argument that someone would say that. That's how I feel about this. I think I enjoy it. I still have a lot of memories and love for it from seeing it as a kid, but watching it now, there's definitely some things where I was like, this is really fast through here because you have to build these relationships. So the pacing is a little weird that way, but no, is it slow? No, I didn't mean to imply that it was a slow movie compared to the original Superman, which does have some real lulls. This start to finish, I didn't pause this today. I watched it straight through again. I love this movie.
So for me, I got to look from two perspectives. If looking at it from a perspective compared to Superman 1, it's not slow. I watched this movie when I was a kid. I watched it multiple times. Looking back now, from this point of view, it's slow. Like from a modern view, I did stop the movie a couple times watching it. I had to. I actually looked at the clock saying, how much more time is left? Oh my God, there's 55 minutes left this movie. I don't remember it being this long. Like, I was like, did I get the longer cut somehow? Just didn't feel like it. And I think there's a lot of things you could have cut out of the movie, I think, just to make the pacing go faster. But for the time it was in, I think it was built properly. Like, it's an 80s movie. It's an early 80s movie. It's built like an early 80s movie. But looking back on a lens that's 40 years older, I think it could have been structured a little bit differently. The issues I was just having with it, just pacing-wise, because I like the Zod stuff, right? But when you had the Superman, it really went super slow. And I think I just had a problem with... I already had the need for it. Like, I understood the love between Lois and Superman. I didn't have to be resold that again, especially from the first movie, right? Because you're right, Jeremy. This movie really should be seen back to back with that first one.
Right.
They're two parts of the same book.
But we also have to remember comics weren't cool then. Like, they were trying to make a movie that was also going to appeal to adults and moviegoers and the actors who had to be in them. Like, they have real actors in this movie. It's not, I know now you can get real actors to be Iron Man, but that took time. That took a bunch of successful movies and people to realize, you know what, these are good. But at this time, there weren't a bunch of other good superhero movies. You've got the Batman from 1966 or whatever, and then years of terrible things that were put out that thankfully were not released, or TV movies, or the Incredible Hulk on TV, like all these things that weren't like appealing. And then you want to do Superman, and you know, people like rolled their eyes, like, of course we're going to do Superman movie. The first one thankfully did well enough. They're like, you know what, we can do a Superman movie, but they'd already filled most of this.
And this movie was at the time, the most expensive movie ever made, which I understand why it's so big. It's supposed to be epic. It has, in my mind, the pacing hasn't aged well for it. As a small kid, I loved it without a doubt.
I think the movies that they make these days, I'm not a big movie fan of big action movies like this as much. I think Avengers was exceptionally well done. The four Avengers movies, the main ones. I mean, the offshoots are fine too. If you're talking about the Ant-Man and Spider-Man and Thor and the Hulk and all those, they're fine, but they're so quick. They're so flashy and they're so fast. And so, yes, he's faster than a speeding bullet. I'm sorry, but the effects that they used in 1978 and 1980 to get him to take off, you know, like this, that's not a speeding bullet. And that's not faster than a speeding bullet. It was limitations of the time are really clear and evident in these movies. And even when they're not, you know, there's a scene in the Colossal Metropolis fight where, it's right before, or maybe it's like, anyway, it's right around the time where Ursa has this big flagpole and she goes, hold him. And then, you know, he drops through Nan's arms and she smacks Nan and some guy goes, wow, home run, you know, but then I don't think it was that one. I think it's when Superman gets pummeled and smashes up against the building and he's like, oh, and then, you know, recoils from the pain. And he turns around, glares, and he takes off, man. And he turns around and then he kind of slows and does a kick. And I'm like, I just don't get what is with the legwork in this movie. Like, sock him, you know, rock him, sock him with your fist. But it's again, not faster than a speeding bullet. So there are definite limitations, but I appreciate the fact that they are fast enough. I appreciate the fact that they are action enough, and it doesn't have to be this flash, because I think what you lose with the modern movies is what you get this question constantly flashing in your mind. What just happened? I mean, it's just executed too fast. And back then you could grasp it a whole lot better.
Well, I think now they expect you to be a fan of the franchise. So you know those characters, right? They don't need to do, I mean, they always do a little bit of an intro of each character, but like they expect that if you're going to go and see one of these movies, you've done either watch the other movies in the series and the TV shows on Disney and everything else. So they can put all this other background in so they can just start a movie with, here's your character. You might have a real quick short summary of like, oh yeah, that's Captain America. He does this. And then it's just action. You don't have to do the buildup. The early movies did have the buildup. So Iron Man, the first Captain America, the first Thor, really, they have this buildup, but the newer ones, they don't need it. It's just like, yeah, these are like Guardians of the Galaxy. I love Guardians of the Galaxy, but they don't have to explain anything. Like, yeah, we're from space where we have these powers. Let's go. And they just start. And you're like, okay, I don't hate it, but it's not, it's more just like, I watch it once and I don't normally watch them again. Like there's a few exceptions to that, but I'll watch them once or twice. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. But I've seen these movies and the earlier Batman movies, the Burton Batman movies, like easily hundreds of times. And I can watch them hundreds of other times more because they're making a more accessible movie that happens to be about superheroes, where superhero movies now are, I mean, enjoyable, but they are superhero movies that are for superhero fans.
I kind of agree with that. They're more, the current ones are more disposable. And I you know, even though I complain about the pacing and everything, I have seen this thing hundreds and hundreds of times. And there's a reason for that. But I think you're right. The newer ones are a little more disposable, where this one you can see multiple times over and over again.
The new ones, much like current comics, or any comics really, but current, I'm currently still reading a bunch of the comic lines. They're just building up to events. Like, so they have all these movies and they have these TV shows and everything, but you can see they're just laying groundwork for, you know, what's going to be the next Thanos, which is, I guess, Doom or whatever. Like they're building up to these event movies. The rest of these things are, I'm disposable, I'm not the right word, but they're blocks. They're not standalone movies. They are blocks to this big thing that if you didn't watch these blocks, the big thing is going to be just like a nonstop music video and it's over. And you're like, what the hell was that? So you need to watch all those other pieces. They do a really good job with the first movie and this movie for Superman to really build. You have these connections. Sure. They're paced a little weird, I think, but you know, it wasn't like who's this person Superman's giving his power for it. It's all laid out for you. You understand like the conflict of why he would make it. And then even when he decides like, this was a mistake, it wasn't this haphazard, like I got my ass beat and I want to be Superman again. He realizes that he's made the wrong sacrifice because the Earth is in trouble. He must try to go back.
So was this a good sequel?
Absolutely. I love both of them so much. And I think they're indispensable from one another. I love sequels. I love movies with sequels, but I love trilogies as well. And I think in that respect, Superman 3 is wonderful as well. It's a little bit hokey and there's a lot more camp in that one with Richard Pryor. Of course, that's going to be expected. But I think it was such a great movie, and it just the scene in Superman 3 with the junkyard fight is one of the most like unexpected, what was that coolness that I just witnessed and I'll never forget scenes. But I think it was so well done, despite the mayhem that happened behind the scenes with Sal Kind and Richard Donner and Richard Lester and all that stuff. I don't care. I think they mopped up the floor and they cleaned everything up and they stitched it together, and what they presented was fun. What I wish we could have is they had a TV release version. That was, you know, not the Richard Lester version that you saw in theaters. It was probably, like, if they were going to call it anything, it'd be the Richard Lester extended cut, because it didn't include the stuff from Richard Donner yet. But it had all these extra scenes, like in the jail scene, he's, you know, asking about the, he's talking to Otis and he says like, you know, something about pasta fagioli, you know, and that's not in the actual movie, right? But Otis and he are having these extended dialogues. I'm like, I want that extended stuff. So. But it's okay. I love it as is, and I think it's a very worthy sequel, a la Aliens to Alien. Very worthy sequel.
Yeah, the same thing happened with the first movie where they had the TV release version, which is much longer than the actual movie. It's because the networks were paying by the minute. The longer the movie, you got paid more for it. So they would just release these cuts that were just massively long extra footage, and you wouldn't really recognize it. You're probably jumping in the middle of the movie. You're only going to watch part of it because of commercial breaks.
Commercials.
They really did. It's like, okay, here's a 3-hour thing to fill up a 3-hour block of your TV, of your, you know, of your programming. That's why those weird cuts came out. So guys, we always do this sort of review of it, but what did you really love about this movie? And what do you think they wish had done a little bit better?
I loved Zod, Ursa, and Nan. I'm glad it wasn't just Zod by himself. I think you needed the multiple superhero or multiple supervillains to kind of, again, they're still learning what their powers are. They also play off each other well. You can have Nan be this kind of threatening yet, yeah, a little bit of comedy in there as well for to kind of lighten the mood. So I do like them a lot. I don't know if I would have done anything different for this time. Again, the newer version of Zod is a different animal. I like it, but I don't know if I would have liked it at the time I saw this. I don't know if the world had been ready for that portrayal of General Zod. Again, my problems, and it's not even a problem because I still, you know, it's hard to pick apart a movie you've watched your entire life and be like, oh, here's something I would change. But I wish there was a better transition of Superman, you know, Lois finding out who Superman is and then him deciding to give up his powers, right? It still seems very sudden. I know you've had a movie and a half to build this out. And there is, you know, even though they didn't expect you to have read 30 years of Superman comics, there is a lot of public knowledge of the history of Superman. So having Lois Lane be the superhero Superman love interest is not out of nowhere. But I wish that would have been a little better written, maybe. I don't know if that's the problem necessarily. Just there's a lot of that I was like, that seems really hasty. And I wish, I know for time you couldn't, but I wish we would have had a little more time of normal Clark, right? With non-powers, just to kind of like, it seems so fast because you have to get back into the movie. But, you know, you see him lose his powers. You see him laying with Lois. You see him at the diner. And he's walking back to be Superman again. Like, it's so fast. I wish there was a little more of the transition back to Superman. But again, for time, I don't know if I would have changed that.
I think the Mario Puzo screenplays were wonderful. Definitely could use some improvement and some, just like Lois said, you know, you could use a tuck here and there yourself, sister. I think that they could have been tucked here and there themselves and been a little bit more cohesive and stuff. I love anything where there's an equal match. You know, you've met your match. So, you know, you talk about the villains, Spider-Man meeting Venom, Superman meeting the triumvirate of Zod and Ursa and Nan. I love... As a kid, I remember watching the Incredible Hulk TV show, and there's an episode called The First, where David Banner in the show, is the Hulk, and he meets another guy, Dell, who suffered the same problem, you know, and they've come up with an antidote and a villain. He's a freaky-looking Hulk. He's really weird. If you Google The First, he's a really weird-looking Hulk. He's not muscular. He just looks like a psychopath who's been electrocuted because his hair's all, you know. But he meets his match. You know, it's an equal on the dark side. And I think that's so cool. And the fact that Superman is faced with not one, but three, or four, if you count Nan twice, as Lex said, the fact that he's faced with three of them and he has to square off against those guys, I think that's just, it just upped the ante and upped the stakes a bit more. It's one of my favorite movies of all time and one that I'm deeply nostalgic. So if you ask me movies from the O's or the 90s or the 80s, I'll go with 80s every time.
This leads to, there's a new Superman movie coming out this year. Conveniently enough, are you looking forward to that movie? Are you excited by it, or you are worried about where it's going to go?
I have really mixed emotions. I'm not sold on David Corenswet. I just don't see him in some of the previews. I don't see Superman in there. I did see Superman and Henry Cavill. Like, who is that guy? And granted, there's the Superman curse you got to worry about, and there's also the Reeves to Christopher Reeve to Gerard Christopher, and all the naming convention was so weird. It's like Corinth Sweat. What? Henry Cavill. What? Super Dog. There's a lot of cringeworthy things if you take it at face value. I think something is going to be worked out in that movie where you go, dude, Super Dog rocks. And it may work out that way. I'll see anything Superman, but I may see this one only once. And I think that's sad because the magic just isn't there like it was with Christopher Reeve in those movies.
Yeah, aside from Batman, most of the DC properties, I have not been incredibly excited about the movie versions of current versions. I mean, I obviously see Superman's and the early Batman's, big fan. But everything else, it feels like they're just not as good for the most part. There are exceptions, like we did Suicide Squad. I actually enjoyed that a lot, but it is very much like a Marvel movie. It's very much just nonstop things happen and it ends, the second Suicide Squad. And that was, I didn't ever see it before. I didn't expect much from it, so I actually quite enjoyed it. And that's how I'm going to go into the Superman. I'm not expecting much from this new version of Superman, everything I've seen, like the Super Dog, and it looks weird. I'm going to be honest, Superman looks way younger than I expected Superman to be. I thought Cavill did a great job. I liked his Superman, even though I didn't necessarily like the movies he was in. I liked that Superman. So we will see how I feel about this. Maybe I'll like the movie and I won't like the Superman this time around. We'll see.
Yeah, I'm going in kind of curious. I've always found, I've said this before on the show, that I think Superman movies are hard to do. Right. Because of his power set, because of his, you know, strength, it's just hard to find a villain that's worthy of Superman that can actually cause him a challenge. Like in this movie, there are three characters who are specifically are just like him, though a little less talented. They've only had the powers for a short amount of time. And it's hard to pull that kind of level of stakes off with a Superman movie. So that's my fear. Gunn at the helm, you said you were like Suicide Squad, that he made that, right? And the things that Gunn has made in recent years, I've enjoyed. So I'm going into it open-minded. I'm hoping it does well, because I like to see DC do well. I like the DC universe, and it's had so many false starts over the past couple decades.
Yeah.
But I'm always worried about a Superman movie as a whole, just because of the power, the power sets involved, basically. Like, to pull it off, you've got to have a power that's massive, but then it'll threaten the entire planet, and that puts it out of scope of every other part of the DC universe. Like, I always found it hard, unless you're going campy, to have, like, a Batman and Superman in the same movie. It was always amusing to see when they try pulling that off, but I'm curious, see where it goes from there. But to the movie we just watched now, Superman 2, imagine someone who has never seen this movie, they've never watched it, should they go out and find it?
Yeah, two thumbs up from me, absolutely. Especially if you're into nostalgic movies that were really movies. They don't make them like they used to. And I think, you know, pacing issues aside, I think we were so much better storytellers back in the 80s and the early 90s. That art has been lost. They're constantly resurrecting. There's nothing new under the sun. They're constantly resurrecting old franchises and old properties and getting these things reinvented. I mean, Spider-Man, how many times has that been reinvented now? And Superman is just, it's one of those movies that stands the test of time. Superman 2, rather, as well as Superman, stand the test of time as Americana. A reflection of where we were at the time. The effects, are they ahead of the time? Star Wars effects were. I don't know about Superman, you know, not necessarily ahead of the time, but such a well-rounded story of action, sci-fi, love, thriller, you know, all of it. Superman 2 has all of that. And it has a powerful story at the helm, the center, which is love, and also the morality tale of this is selfish. It's utterly selfish of Superman and Lois to have Superman renounce his powers. Utterly selfish. So they can have a little, you know, romp in the silver cushion sack. I mean, it just, you know, mother, I love her. Okay, I get that. That's nice and really nice. But think of, you're here to fight for truth and justice in the American way. Not that. So I don't know. But I definitely would recommend seeing it. It's Americana.
Yeah, I much like the first one I recommended, I recommend this one even more, although I do think you kind of need to see the first one to appreciate this as well. I mean, you don't absolutely have to. They do the flashbacks, but and you don't need an introduction on who Superman is necessarily in 2025. But if you hadn't seen it, I think watching them, maybe not back to back, but one day, then the next day, you know, watch the first two. But I highly recommend this movie. I think of the Superman movies, this is my favorite. I love the third one, too, for totally different reasons, but I think as a standalone, I'd much rather recommend this to somebody than Superman 3.
Yeah. Can I add, just real quick, I don't think I've ever seen a movie where they've interspersed in the credits flashbacks from the previous movie. you're plunged into the action right away. If you've never seen Superman, you know what Superman is all about from the opening credits of Superman 2 with the thunderous, you know, swelling music and all of these scenes that just spell out the whole story, you know, in these quick cuts. I think it was brilliant for them to do that way.
Yeah, it's basically a previously on.
Yeah, exactly. Good way to put it.
So for me, I like the way you put that. It's a piece of Americana. It's like a piece of history, right? Like, it's like telling someone to go see The Godfather in the sense of, like, is it still good now? Would it, you know, maybe? Are there better mobster movies now? Maybe. But it was a piece of its time, and I think it's worth revisiting for people who haven't seen it because to go experience it, because it's a different kind of Superman than you're going to get today. It's kind of like when we watch, Batman 66. That's not the Batman you're going to see today, right? But I recommend to go see that Batman because that's a Batman you're not going to get today.
I think that's an extreme case if you're going to go from Batman 66 to anything after that. But I still think, like, this is the first Superman in this movie are kind of, I mean, this built this genre to be a realistic movie genre. It wasn't, I mean, the Batman 66 was a TV tie-in. It was fine. It was enjoyable, but it was not like, it didn't start a whole series of like, we can make these superhero movies and make them better. This really did. I mean, it wasn't like back to back to back, but it was Superman and then a bunch of stuff that wasn't great. And then Batman, the 1989 Batman that was also like kind of restarted this. And then, you know, that did lead to a bunch of bad Superman superhero movies at the time. But, you know, now it's like a thing. But I think Superman was the first one that really took that idea. We can have this movie that takes superheroes seriously, but is also, you know, still a movie. It's not like, oh yeah, superheroes are everywhere and they he's a special case, and it's kind of the why this movie works out. It's a special case, but it's filmed like a real movie. I highly recommend.
Yeah, I think it is the transition period of comics for kids. And this was the movie is still for kids, not just for kids. It's for the whole family.
Right.
But we can take the material serious versus it's just a animated thing. Not like Garfield, of course. That's very serious.
No, but I mean, Batman 66 is a good comparison, right? Like that is definitely tongue-in-cheek. The whole thing is tongue-in-cheek. That nothing is, it's Batman. And they have the, you know, towards the end, you have the big boff, pow, bam stuff. Like all that's in there. This is, no, none of that. This is a realistic portrayal of what Superman would be like on Earth. I think it's good.
Out of...
So guys, what's your final rating?
I'm going to get... This is probably the second time I've given a thumbs up to a movie, like a full thumbs up that wasn't partial, but it's my five-year-old thumb up. It's a five-year-old's hand thumb up.
I'm going to go two thumbs up again, just for the pure nostalgia of it, the fact that they brought him to life so well that Christopher Reeve absolutely set the stage as the quintessential, you know, never-to-be-dethroned Superman in one and two and three. Four, meh. Kind of deflated a lot of that. But yeah, I mean, definitely two thumbs up and three if I had another arm.
I would give it one cellophane thumb up. It's it's good, but it kind of lingers a little bit for too long. Okay, Jeremy, before we head out, I actually have a mailbag for us.
Oh, that's unfortunate. All right.
Okay, so this came in actually just a few days ago. Love the show. I'm really enjoying the clips at the end of end of the show. How long have you been doing that? I don't think they're on the earlier episodes.
I'll answer for Jeremy. Been doing it for a long time. We're the best podcast ever. And there were a lot of shows.
We actually started that a few months ago. And basically what I do is I take bloopers or I take little things I found funny in the episode, just stick it at the end after the credits. Thanks for being on the show, by the way. I loved having you on. It was a lot of fun. I think you picked a great movie for us to discuss. But where can people find you? And what are you working on?
Yeah. So this is my favorite question. So I'm at authoraaronryan.com. I always have to clarify in case there's a poor connection. It's not awfulaaronryan.com. It's authoraaronryan.com. Although I ponied up and bought that domain because just in case people try, I wonder if awfulaaronryan.com takes you.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. So you could go there. So authoraaronryan.com will take you to my authoring site. And you can also visit the Dissonance Sci-Fi Alien Invasion series. Volume one of that series has been adapted for the screen. It's being pitched to streaming networks right now, so I'm pretty stoked about that. And that is my pride and joy. It's a six-book series. DissonanceTheSeries.com or AliensSaga.com is another website you can go to get there. I'm currently working on a clean fiction Christian post-apocalyptic series. It's not Revelation. It's not the end. It's not biblical tie-in with Revelation. But it is very, very similar, and there are some disturbing similarities between a psychopathic techno-trillionaire who's got worldwide domination aspiration. But it's turned out really good. It's called The End, and you can go to thisisnottheend.com for that one. Now that I've completely buried you in URLs.
Well, by the way, I have all those links in the show notes as well, so people can find you. And always on our guest tab, they can easily find your information. So, and Jeremy, where can people find you?
Well, I'm here every other week for another episode of Movie Smash, but also at Retrovania.net, where there's links to our podcast, Retrovaniacs, plus some streams I do, plus everything else we put online about old video games. So if you want to talk about old movies, come here, old video games, go to Retrovaniacs.
And for me, you can always find me at Off Panel Creations. We're always over there building some piece of nerdy furniture. But thank you, our listeners, for spending some time with us today. And if you have a better idea on what continent Lex Luthor should have asked for besides Australia, send us a note over at movie-smash.com, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. This has been Movie Smash with Chris Roberts, Jeremy Parmentier, and Fergal Amayo, produced by me, Chris Roberts, executive produced by Off Panel Creations, LLC. Movie clips provided by the respective studios. You can rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You might even find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for us? Visit us at movie-smash.com and send us a note. It too can be read on a future episode. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Movie Smash wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Say, here's what happened, dumb 4-year-old.